Okay, we're back to the Sermon on the Mount, and I'm kind of entitling this message Video Clips of the Kingdom. I start vignettes of the kingdom, video clips of the kingdom, because what he's doing here, once you understand who he's talking to and where they're going, what he's preparing them for, then everything falls in place here. A lot of my Christian commentaries come and they try to make this apply to the Christians and the dispensation of grace, but then of course they have to throw a bunch of God's truth away. They have to say he doesn't really mean what he says. It's too hard. No one could actually do what he's saying here. And they say, so he didn't really mean what he said. What he really meant is just supposed to be a goal set before us, or some other stuff like that. And I just talked to a Christian earlier this week who was in despair when they would come to Matthew 5, because they thought they were going to hell because they knew as a Christian, they weren't fulfilling what Matthew 5 said. And of course, that's the situation you get into when you don't rightly divide the scripture. This passage has to do with this believing remnant. Christ has come. He's preaching the gospel to the ruined nation who's been under the fifth course of punishment for hundreds of years. And he is preaching to them the good news of the kingdom. The king has arrived, fulfilling the Davidic covenant, beginning to at least fulfill the Davidic covenant. God himself said to Abraham or to David that he himself would enter into the line of David, take on his humanity, and be Israel's kinsman redeemer, Israel's deliverer, Israel's avenger, Israel's king, and Israel's blesser. And that is the good news of the kingdom. The king has arrived. God's begun to fulfill that Davidic covenant and carry out his plan and purpose for the nation of Israel. And when you realize that, he preaches this good news. Those who believe, their faith, just like with Abraham in the past and just like the Galatians in the future, when they believe God's good news to them, this gospel of the kingdom, when they believe that, their faith was counted for righteousness. They were justified unto eternal life. And that's the entry point for entering into that Abrahamic covenant and to be to receive all of its blessings. See, that's where the religious leadership in Israel got it all wrong. They thought they were automatically included as benefactors in the Abrahamic covenant just because they were the natural children of Abraham through Isaac. But you see, they weren't going back far enough in Abraham's history. They need to go back farther, because before all that was in play, Abraham, God just preached good news to Abraham, an idol-worshiping Gentile, an ungodly sinner on enemy status before him, and he just preached the good news to Abraham. Abraham believed, and his faith was counted for righteousness. Paul springs off that, and he tells the Galatians that they were saved in that same way. God came proclaiming the good news to the Galatians through Paul, and that good news, of course, was that the good news of the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. He came proclaiming that good news to the Galatians. They believed it, and their faith was counted for righteousness. And here Jesus is proclaiming the good news of the kingdom. They believe that, and they're brought in, their faith is counted for righteousness, and they're brought in to Israel's prophetic program, made benefactors of that Abrahamic covenant, placed in that believing remnant, and that's who Christ is addressing here in Matthew. He's talking about this believing remnant, and he just told us in the Beatitudes that their great blessing is that they are going to be the ones to receive the kingdom. The kingdom is theirs. The kingdom that will cover the earth is there. They're going to enter that kingdom where they'll see God, they'll be his children, they'll be his peace dispensers, his mercy dispensers, his righteousness dispensers. And that promise is laid out for them. They're blessed because they're going to receive what every Israelite only wished to receive, only wished to know more about, what all the prophets only hope to know more about, what even the angelic realm hope to know more about. This generation he's calling out would be the recipients of the beginning of the fulfillment of all those kingdom promises that have been around for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. That's why they're blessed. Now, when we left the Beatitudes, they might come to the conclusion that this glorious kingdom the glory of this kingdom they would enter into immediately. But he explains to them, first, there's going to have to be a time of persecution. And of course, when we remember Daniel's time schedule, remember this is the fifth course of punishment. They've been through the Babylonian captivity. They've been through Medo-Persian reign in the return to Israel, but still under Gentile control. They've just finished with that 400 years of silence in which God went back to his place and didn't speak to Israel, though he did leave her the writing prophets. And now he broke the silence with John the Baptist when he talked to John the Baptist in the wilderness. And now the fourth installment of that fifth course of punishment, Christ's earthly ministry, kicks into action. And when that's over at the cross and the resurrection, the only thing left on Daniel's time schedule will be that seven-year tribulation period. And so when you realize that, then now he's called out this believing remnant, and he's going to start explaining to them that they're not going to enter immediately into the glory of the kingdom first. There'd be a time of persecution. Look at verse 43, because this will set us up for what we do in the rest of chapter 5. Matthew 5, verse 10. Matthew 5, verse 10. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. They're going to have to go through this time of persecution. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. See, that's not going to be a chief characteristic of that kingdom that's under the reign and rule of Christ. They're going to have to go through something before they get into that kingdom. This is what we call that tribulation period, a time of suffering and persecution at the hands of the apostate leadership, the apostate nation, at the hands of the Gentiles, and at the hands of the satanic realm behind them, who has a policy of evil against them, trying to stamp them out before they get to that kingdom. So there's going to be a time of persecution before then. And the key thing, as we flip the page now in chapter 5 and get into finish off this chapter, the key thing he's trying to do here is he's trying to explain to them that they need to separate, dissociate from the apostate leadership in Israel. And, you know, it's not just like someone telling us to go leave a church or something like that. The synagogue was the basis of their whole life, not just their religious life, but their social life, their economic life. This would uproot everything. The Pharisees had said, those who follow Jesus are at risk of being cut off from the synagogue. And we see John talks about that, the healing of the blind man. Remember, his parents they're like, he's of age, don't drag us into this, because they had threatened that they'd be cut off from the synagogue. That would disrupt their whole lives. So there'd be a hesitation by this believing remnant now to separate and dissociate from that apostate religious system, because their whole lives is really based on it. And so he first gives them a couple reasons why they need to separate from this apostate system. And that's what we're going to look at now. So look at verse 17, 18, 19, and 20. I'll put some of the slides up here. Okay, the kingdom, the main drive of this passage is that the kingdom is not going to operate like the nation in Jesus' day. That's what he's going to drive this home for the rest of chapter 5 and really on into chapter 6. The kingdom is not, he's going to show that the kingdom doesn't operate like the nation of Israel in that day. And he's going to bring this out, and he's going to look at verse 17. Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. And why were they saying he was trying to destroy the law? Well, he was trying to destroy the law, but it wasn't the written law of Moses. It was the oral law of the apostate leaders. They would take, so a critical thing to understand is they would take a small bit of Moses' written law, you know, and he's going to use examples in the rest of this chapter, a little bit like thou shalt not kill or thou shalt not commit adultery. They'll take a little bit of Moses' written law, and then they cover that up. They bury that over with their commentaries and their interpretations and the traditions of men, and then they preach that, and they put that on the same level, if not a higher level, than the written law itself. And that's what Jesus comes to destroy. That's what he's doing in the rest of this chapter. He's going to start ripping off those traditions of men, throwing away those commentaries that have been piling up, burying the law over the last hundreds of years. When these religious leaders should have been feasting on God's word that he left them, those writing prophets, and feasting on the poetic books and feasting on the law of Moses itself and the historical books, when they should have been feasting on that, instead they were burying that under their own commentaries, interpretations, and traditions, so that by the time you get to Jesus' day, they don't even know really what the written law is anymore. And Jesus now is coming. They're saying he's destroying the law. Well, he's destroying their oral law, but he's bringing out unburying and purifying the written law of Moses. We went back to Micah to see how that fits in there last week. But now the main point here, the kingdom, they need to know if they're going to separate from this apostate leadership, they needed to realize it's not going to operate in the way that the nation did in Jesus' day. Verse 19, whosoever therefore shall break one of the least of these commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called least in the kingdom, and whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be great in the kingdom of heaven. That's what we were just talking about, that they take a little bit of the law of Moses and then they bury it under their traditions. They take the various aspects of the law of Moses and say some are important and some aren't. Some you have to pay attention to, other things you can neglect and ignore. And he's going to do this in the rest of chapter 5 by bringing out their emphasis on external acts of the law, like thou shalt not commit murder and thou shalt not commit adultery. Sins, right? And they do fall under God's judgment. But Jesus is going to bring that back, and he's going to say that in doing that, they're neglecting another aspect of the law. They're neglecting the internal aspect of the law, the heart aspect of the law. And they're going to not think those things are important. Things like anger and lust are less important than just not committing a murder, not committing adultery. And then, so there we have the inner and heart elements of the law are relegated to insignificance, and the external big acts of the law are relegated to ultimate importance. But it's even worse than that. We won't turn there, but Matthew 23:23, he gives the flip side of that. They even made the small external things of the law more important than the internal things of the law. They would spend all their time tithing small amounts of spices, but then they would ignore the weighty things of the law, things like judgment and faith and mercy. And that's what they were doing here. And he wants them to realize that that is not the way the kingdom is going to operate. In the kingdom, they're going to be doing their emphasis is going to be on the whole law, and it's not going to begin with the external acts, big or small. It's going to begin with the internal condition of the heart and the inner man. And that is, so that's one reason why they should feel free to associate from the apostate religious system, because in the kingdom, the ones who were ruling in that day and the way it was ruled in that day isn't the way it's going to be ruled and be structured in the kingdom. In the kingdom, the law is going to be fully implemented, including the things of the heart and the inner man. Now, verse 20, he's going to give a second reason why they should feel free to separate from this apostate religious system that up till this point their whole life has been based on. For I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. Now he brings up another thing. In the previous verse, he's driving home the kingdom isn't going to be structured like the way the nation is structured in that day. And here he says those who are ruling in that day won't even be in that kingdom for the most part. And I'm sure there were some exceptions, like perhaps Nicodemus, but for the bulk of it, they could separate from that religious religious leadership, because those people were not going to be the leaders and rulers in that kingdom. You had to have a righteousness that exceeds that of the Pharisees. And this isn't keeping the law more fastidiously than them or anything like that. It goes back to Matthew 3, where it shows their fundamental beginning point, stumbling point, where they get disqualified from the race right at the beginning because they had replaced faith righteousness and replaced it with natural righteousness. They thought they were automatically a benefactor of Israel's prophetic program and the Abrahamic covenant just because they were the children of Abraham. When in fact, the way you became a participant in Israel's prophetic program and a benefactor of that Abrahamic covenant was by faith righteousness that brought you into that situation. So they stumbled at the starting point. They got disqualified in the first step of the race. They were already out of the picture because they replaced faith righteousness with natural righteousness, disqualified at the very beginning. And of course, that's the root of all their problems as they go on through here. Natural, contrary to the oral law of the apostate leaders, which buried Moses' law under the traditions of men, the law of Moses was always intended to be in the heart. I think this is an important point to bring out as we enter into these examples he's going to give here, because a lot of the Christian commentaries I have indicate that Jesus is doing something here that I don't think he really is. Some say that he's kind of setting aside Moses's law and replacing it with his law. You know, they might say the law for the church, the body of Christ, Christ's law, or something like that. That's not what he's doing here. Others, and even some dispensational teachers, will say that he's intensifying the law. He's expanding it. He's adding to it. The law itself dealt mostly with external things. Jesus here is bringing it now and intensifying and enlarging it to include heart things. But, you know, that's really not what he's doing either. What he's doing in this the rest of chapter 5 is he is going to now take the law of Moses and unbury it, rip away all the teachings and traditions and interpretations of men, and bring it up to the surface again, purify it, and hold it up in its pristine form. The law of Moses was always meant to start in the heart. Let's just look at a couple passages, and you can see as we follow through this. Go back to Deuteronomy 5:29. Deuteronomy 5:29. And here Deuteronomy, of course, means second giving of the law. They're in the plains of Moab. Hopefully, I won't review it here, but hopefully some of you remember in the plains of Moab while Moses was rehearsing the law with the second generation. Remember, the first generation had died in the wilderness for the most part. Now the second generation is here and they're ready to enter that land. And Moses is rehearsing the law with them, giving them the law for the second time as they're ready to enter into that land. Hopefully, some of you remember what's going on while they're down in the plains and valley of Moab, what was going on in the hills of Moab, the Balaam and Balak episode, where God proclaimed to the universe that he would never, ever, ever change his mind about Israel. Not Israel would be his distinct nation. It would be separate from all other nations of the world. There's nothing anyone, anywhere, anytime can ever do to get him to set aside his plan and purpose for Israel. Nothing in the physical realm, not all the Gentile nations of that day, not a historic Christianity that dispenses with Israel. None of those things in the physical realm are going to discard what God's plan and purpose for Israel. Nothing in the spiritual realm is going to discard God's plan and purpose, get him to change his mind about his plan and purpose for Israel. And even Israel and her rebellion entering in this law and soon under its curses, even that would not get God to change his mind about Israel. He is going to fulfill his plan and purposes with Israel. even if historic Christianity says he's not, God and his word and his truth say he is. And he proclaimed that to Balaam and Balak, and the physical, earthly, human, spiritual, satanic, angelic realms, that was the case. Okay, let's go to Matthew. So that's what's going on in the hills. Let's go back down to the valley and see what Moses is doing down in the valley with the children of Israel. As they're ready to enter the land, he's rehearsing the law with them. Look at Deuteronomy 5, verse 29. And we're just going to flip through these. We're not going to develop any of these. You'll see a trend. Chapter 5, verse 29. Oh, that there were such a heart in them. Notice it's the heart thing. He's giving this law for the second time, and his prayer is that, oh, that there would be such a heart in them that they would fear me. See, it starts in the heart. It starts with fearing the Lord, trusting in the Lord, and keep all my commandments always, that it might be well with them and their children forever. Flip over a page to chapter 6. Verse 6. Well, let's begin at verse 5 because those are such amazing words. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with thine heart and with thy soul and with all thy might. Notice the train of activity there. It starts in the heart, and it spreads, it permeates into the soul, the inner man, the inner person, and then it goes and is extended out to mighty acts. Verse 6. And these words which I command thee this day, this is the law of Moses. He's giving it to him for the second time, the first time for this generation, but the second time to the nation of Israel. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. See, they're always meant to be in the heart. They're not supposed to be just rituals which they had become under the apostate leader. They were always supposed to be a heart response. They were always supposed to be in the heart. And then verse 7, and thou shalt teach them diligently. Does that sound like what he just described in Matthew 5 with regard to how that kingdom is going to operate? In that kingdom, it's going to be start in the heart, and then it's going to permeate the inner man, and then that's going to lead to service in that kingdom based on the full and complete law of Moses. Look at chapter 11, verse 18. Chapter 11, verse 18. Therefore, shall ye lay up these words in your heart. See, these words are supposed to be in their heart. That's the starting point for everything. The apostate leadership had made the heart something you could ignore and neglect. But it's for Moses, it's a starting point. Therefore, ye lay up these words in your heart and in your soul, and bind them for a sign upon your hand and upon the frontlets of between your eyes, and ye shall teach them your children. Notice the flow. It starts in the heart, it spreads to the inner man, then it goes to the external acts, and then you are qualified to teach. Who is teaching in Israel in Jesus' day? Those who neglected the heart, those who didn't hold a value to what was going on in the inner man. They just cared about externals. They were automatically disqualified from teaching because they weren't teaching following Moses's way of teaching, starting in the heart, spreading to the whole inner man, and then external acts come into play. And once you have that system in mind, then you're qualified to teach the whole law of Moses to others. Go over to chapter 26. I think you're getting the general trend here, but let's just look at one or two more. Chapter 26, verse 16. This day, he's giving the second giving of the law. This day, the Lord thy God hath commanded thee to do these statutes and judgment. Thou shalt therefore keep them with all thine heart and with all thine soul. Go over to chapter 30, verse 10. Chapter 30, verse 10. If thou shalt hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God to keep his commandments and his statutes, which are written in this book of the law, and if thou turn unto the Lord thy God with all thine heart and all thine soul, he brings it, it's written in the book, that those words are supposed to be put in the heart, that's supposed to permeate the soul, and then that leads to external acts. Verse 11, for this commandment, which I command thee this day, it is not written from thee, neither is it far off. It is not in heaven. And he goes on there that thou should say, who shall go up to us for heaven and bring it to us that we may do it. It's now on the other side of the sea. We don't need to send somebody to heaven to find these words and explain them to us. We don't need to send someone to the other part of the sea to get these words and bring them to us. See, that's what the apostate leadership was doing. They were taking the words of Moses and then they were adding to them and stretching it. They told people they had to come to them to understand them. They had to go and get more information, more explanations, more commentaries and traditions, interpretations of men. Where are these words? Verse 14, but the word is very near unto thee in thy mouth and in thy heart that thou mayest do them. It's a heart thing. It's right there. They didn't need to be overlaid with the traditions and interpretations and commentaries of the religious apostate system. They just need to be brought in the written words of Moses need to be brought in the heart and begin to operate there. 32, chapter 32, 45. And Moses made an end. Now we're at the end of this. Has anything changed? And Moses made an end of the speaking, all these words to all Israel. And he said unto them, set your hearts upon all the words which I testify among you this day, which ye shall command your children to do, to observe, to do, and all of this law. And he ends. Here we are at the end of the second giving. And the goal of this law was to be in their hearts. That was the starting point. Not the external commands, not just ritualize these externally, but to have them in the heart and operate from the heart and through the inner man and then lead to external acts. The national Israel's fundamental problem was not in their external acts, but in the condition of their hearts. They were uncircumcised of heart. Go back to, as long as we're in Deuteronomy, go to Deuteronomy 10, and then we'll head back to Matthew. Deuteronomy 10, and let's just see the problem in Israel. What's the basic problem for Israel? Deuteronomy 10, verse 16. They needed to circumcise, therefore, the foreskin of your heart and be no more stiff-necked. That's the problem. They had a heart that they refused to let this law sink into. They had to first circumcise their heart before they could carry out the law. And that's where it all fell apart. Their problem was a heart problem, not an external act problem. It was a heart problem. And they entered this law, remember, we've been over this several times, in rebellion against God. God had said, I will do everything for you. And at Sinai, they said, no, we will do everything for ourselves. So God chiseled the law on stones and said, okay, do it. But there was no, and their flesh, there was no power to do it because their hearts were wrong. They had a heart problem. Let's see if this is going to last forever. Go to the end now. Go back to the end of Deuteronomy, chapter 30, verse 6. Chapter 30, verse 6. And now what they could not do, and their 1,500-year history is going to show they couldn't do, verse 6 of chapter 30, and the Lord thy God will circumcise thine heart and the heart of thy seed, to love the Lord thy God with all thine heart and with all thy soul, that thou mayest live. What they couldn't do, he's going to do for them. And the critical thing to keep in mind is that's what he's beginning to do in Matthew 5. Remember, let's go back to Matthew 5. Remember the kingdom, where this believing remnant is going. They're going into this kingdom with all its blessings. And what are some of the blessings? Well, let's just name a couple. Satan will be bound, so they won't have that issue in the kingdom. Christ will be reigning on his throne in Jerusalem, so there will be no injustice in the land. The knowledge of God and the righteousness of God will flood the earth, cover the earth as the waters cover the sea. All that will be in place, and they'll have those new covenant blessings. And for our purposes here in Matthew 5, those new covenant blessings is fulfilling what he said over in Deuteronomy 30. God himself will circumcise their heart. That's that new covenant blessing. He will give them a new heart. And then he's going to engrave Moses' law there, not on stones like he did back at Sinai, but in their heart. And then he's going to give them the Spirit to cause them to do them. And they will be able to completely and perfectly fulfill what Christ is saying and the rest of Matthew 5. That's who it's sent. That's who he's speaking to. That's the time in which it will be able to be fully realized. Okay, so with that in mind, we've been through the first two here quickly last week, and we'll just finish up the chapter at this time. So the nation of Israel's fundamental problem was not in their external acts, but in the condition of their hearts. They were uncircumcised in heart. That's going to be addressed in the new covenant provision. Those 10 commandments are concluded with the capstone command. See, they were forgetting something. They were just picking and choosing their commands. But the commandment that ended all the commandments, the capstone commandment of all, the commandment that took down the Apostle Paul, well, Saul slash the Apostle Paul, the commandment that killed him, the commandment that ends all the commandments, and that all the commandments lead into or out of, thou shalt not covet. And that's a heart issue, an inner man issue. And they were forgetting, they were focused on thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery, but they were forgetting the capstone commandment of all, thou shalt not covet. Coveting is what leads to idolatry that breaks the relationship with God. Coveting is what leads to using others for their own purposes that destroys their relationship with others. They were focusing on other commands, even Sabbath keeping and other ones that they were adding their traditions to, but they were forgetting the capstone commandment of all, thou shalt not covet, which is a heart, an inner man issue. So let's pick it up now. With all that in mind, let's pick it up now. And remember, he's talking to a regular audience here. This isn't a group of, he's focusing on the disciples. That's how it starts. But by the time we get to the end, he's talking to the multitudes. So he's addressing just regular people, people like you and like me. And he's preaching a message here. And so he's going to use figures of speech. He's going to use to drive home his point. And so when we read through this, there's even some of this is comical. There's some comical parts in here that when you look at, but his main gist he's doing is he's driving home the point that the kingdom isn't going to operate like the nation in those days. Ye have heard, verse 21. We're back in Matthew 5, 21. You have heard that it was said by them of old, thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of judgment. Okay, so they take this one command from the written law of Moses, thou shalt not kill. And they say you'll be worthy of judgment, and that's true. Verse 22, but I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger in judgment. See, Jesus now is going to take it into heart. What the apostate leaders did is they would say, especially for the rich and powerful, especially for the rich and powerful men who were their associates, they would excuse their unmerciful acts. They would excuse their acts of anger. They would excuse their acts of vindictiveness as long as it fell short of actually committing murder. Or killing someone, then they didn't have to worry so much about the judgment of God. But Jesus takes that and he says, no, you're not going to use the law for your own advantage and for the advantage of others who you rely on. He says, the law calls on the fact that it's in the heart that this all starts. And we just read that through the book of Deuteronomy. He says that it's the anger in the heart is just as worthy, if not more worthy, than the external act of murder, because it's what causes murder. It's more fundamental. If you address the anger in the heart, then you'll automatically address the external act of murder. And now he's going to, and we'll just finish reading through this. So that's what he's in danger. And then he's going to use some hyperbole here to drive this point home. He's trying to drive, they've been told their whole lives that the critical thing is that you don't have to, as long as what you do falls short of murdering someone, then it's, you don't have to worry about God. You don't have to worry about receiving a lot of judgment or something like that. But he's going to turn that on them through some hyperbolics. So using some superlatives, he's going to drive home the point that no, what happens in the heart is more fundamental, more worthy of judgment even than the external act. I say unto you that whosoever shall say to his brother Raca, or blockhead, or something like that in our English, shall be in danger of the council, but whosoever shall say thou fool shall be in danger of hellfire. He's now bringing this point. He says that's critical. He's using hyperbole to drive home this point. And he's explaining that, and he's going to give a couple pictures now of what that's going to look like in the kingdom. In the kingdom, they're not going to excuse anger in the heart, vindictiveness, unmerciful acts, all that kind of stuff that comes from anger in the heart. That's where they're going to be, the kingdom, that's where it's going to all begin. That's what's going to be addressed first. And then he gives some examples here. Look at verse 23. Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest thy brother has anything against you, leave there thy gift before the altar, and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother and then come and offer the gift. And he's offering the gift to God. So he's saying the way that kingdom's going to operate is totally different than the way the nations operated in that day. The priests would have just said, just bring us your gifts, give us your offerings. As long as you have been committed an actual act of murder, you can go ahead and you can kind of not be too worried about God's judgment. And Jesus says, no, in the kingdom, if there's somebody offering a gift to God in the middle, and they suddenly remember that they've done something to cause anger in a brother's heart, then they jump up, they run, they find the brother, they reconcile, they do whatever they need to do to alleviate anger in the heart, their heart or the heart of others. Look at verse 25, he even pushes us further. Verse 25, in the previous verse, it had to do with a brother, a friend, a brother. But verse 25, agree with thine adversary. He says, this is even the way the kingdom's going to operate in the presence of adversaries. Quickly, while thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge delivers you to the officer, and the officer delivers you to prison. Verily, I say unto you, thou shalt by no means come out thence till thou hast paid the uttermost farthing. That's what's going to happen in that kingdom. In the kingdom, they're going to do whatever needs to be done. They're going to do at all costs, as if their life depended on it, alleviate anger and all the things that flow out of anger in the heart. From other internal sins like merciless act, lack of mercy, vindictiveness, all that kind of stuff, and leads to external acts of mercilessness and murder. That's the way that kingdom is not going to operate like Israel their day, where all that's excused. In the kingdom, it's going to operate. They're going to wake up in the morning and they're going to say, I'm going to go find any anger I see festering. And they're going to do whatever they can do, as though their life depended on it, to alleviate anger. Look at the next one. Ye have heard, verse 27, of old, that it was said by them of old, thou shalt not commit adultery. And of course, that's one of the Ten Commandments. But I say unto you, that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. And here you have the Moses did actually write, thou shalt not commit adultery, but they're forgetting, thou shalt not covet. And that's just as important, if not more important, than thou shalt not commit adultery. And what the apostate leaders of Israel did is they came up with this whole system of interpretations and commentaries and traditions whereby, especially, and I'll say it again, rich, powerful men are able to dispense with their wife for virtually any reason whatsoever so that the men could go and follow the lust of their heart and marry another woman, even to the ruin of their wife. Even by the time you get to Jesus' day, you have basically, they could set aside their wife, put away their wife for any reason whatsoever. And they thought, the apostate leader and their logic and their reasoning, they said this alleviated adultery because it allowed the man to follow the lust in his heart and go marry another woman, then he wouldn't commit adultery. But we're going to see Jesus proves that wrong. Now let's look at the hyperbole. He brings it, he takes it from the external command. It's not just a matter of external adultery. It's a what's going on in the heart and the lust of the heart that needs to be addressed. And here's the hyperbole in 29 and 30. And if thy right hand offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee, for it is profitable that that for thee that one of thy members should perish and not the whole body should be cast into hell. And if thy right hand offend thee, cut it off and cast it from thee, for it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish and not that thy whole body be cast into hell. See, he's using hyperbole to show that in this kingdom, they are going to do whatever it takes. They're going to pay whatever it costs. It's going to operate on the principle that anything needed to be done, not just to alleviate the external act of adultery, but to alleviate the internal lust that causes adultery. That's what he's bringing out here. He's purifying this law so it can be put in the heart. And when they're in that kingdom, they're going to fulfill this. That's how they're going to wake up. That's how they're going to start their day. They're going to do whatever it takes. Imagine a world. This is what John Lennon should have been writing in his Imagine song. Instead of the nonsense he wrote, he should have been writing, imagine a world where Christ reigning on his throne, the world in perfect righteousness, and everybody got up in the morning, and the first thing they thought as they got up out of bed is, I'm going to go and everybody I contact with alleviate anger at as if my life depended on it. I'm going to get out of bed and I'm going to go out and I am going to alleviate lust in the heart as though my life depended on it at any cost. That's how the kingdom's going to be set up. How is the days of Jesus was the nation set up? How is the our own nation set up? Well, you just need to listen to the political parties, and you see they get up every morning not to alleviate anger in their hearts or the hearts of others, but to instill anger in their hearts and the hearts of others. Our internet and our entertainment industry, they wake up every day and they wonder how they can, in a commercial and business, commercial people make commercials, how can we incite lust in the heart? See, that's not the way the kingdom's going to operate. The believing remnant needed to realize that. To separate from that apostate nation. It's not going to operate like that. In the kingdom, people at all costs, and as though their life depended on it, they're going to be spending all their time and energy and effort in alleviating anger, in alleviating lust. That's how that kingdom is going to be operating. And said, whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. But I say unto you, so this is what I talked about earlier, the apostate leadership for their rich, powerful men they associate with, they wanted to be excused by the religious leaders and many of the religious leaders themselves to be able to get rid of their wives so that they could follow the lusts of their heart and marry another woman. Of course, to the great detriment and destruction of their first or previous wives. And so they come out of this whole system where by the time you get to Jesus's day, they could put away the wife, the wife could be put away for virtually any reason whatsoever. Now, that's what this religious leaders came up with as the solution to not commit adultery. They see they forgot about thou shalt not covet. And they were just addressing thou shalt not commit adultery. So they said, well, in order to prevent these people from engaging in the external act of adultery, let's make it really easy for them, especially our rich, powerful men friends, to put away their wives, and then they can marry again. Follow the lust of their heart and marry again. See, they haven't committed adultery, external adultery. But Jesus now turns that all upside down. They thought they were alleviating external adultery, but look what Jesus says in verse 32. But I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causes her to commit adultery. You see what he's doing here now? They thought they were alleviating adultery, and instead they've just brought on through these divorce letters of divorcement an avalanche of adultery. Look what he says, causes her to commit adultery, and whosoever shall marry her that is divorced committeth adultery too. And so they thought they were satisfying God and alleviating the external act of adultery, but through their divorcements, they just brought on an avalanche of adultery in the eyes of God. Such is the foolishness of religious traditions and commentaries and interpretations. So he's not going to do that. All right. Let's look at the next one on oath taking. Again, and you kind of see the flow here. They're all set up the same way. Again, ye have heard that it's been said by them of old. All right, so this is something that has, they've taken one little thing out of the written word of Moses, and then they add their traditions and their interpretations and their traditions. Again, ye have heard that it has been said by them of old, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thy oaths. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is the God's throne, neither by earth, it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And what he's saying there is some people find it a little complicated, but it's just like us saying, we don't want to actually swear by God's name himself, and neither did Israel or the Jews. So what do you do? What do we do? Well, our way, we would say, if we really want to make a point and we swear, what do? We swear on a Bible. We take an oath on a Bible. Or if we really are serious and really want to make people think, at least think, that we're telling the truth, we'll swear on a stack of Bibles. Well, that's what they're doing here. They're not going to swear on God's name himself. They're going to swear on heaven or on earth or on the Jerusalem or something like that. And Jesus just discards all that nonsense, tradition and interpretation, as just utter nonsense. And now verse 36. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. What he's driving home there is swearing doesn't change the facts. When do we swear? The most, especially the most vociferously, when we're lying, right? Maybe I'm exposing something about my own self, but usually the people who are make the strongest oaths and are swearing on that stack of Bibles, usually it's because they're trying to make it look like they didn't do something they did, or they're lying about something they did do. And see, his point here is swearing on a stack of Bibles isn't going to change the fact. If what's in your heart isn't going to make that align with what you're saying in your oath, it's not true. You can't change it. And that's not the way the kingdom is going to be operating. You don't need to make oaths in the kingdom, because there, with that new heart, with the engraved law and the Holy Spirit empowering them to carry it out, with all that in place, they will move their years first. 37, their communication will be yea, yea, nay, nay, for whatsoever is more than this comes from evil. Evil, of course, is in the heart. He says the oath taking won't even be needed in that kingdom, because what's true on the inside will be what's said on the outside. Oath taking won't even be necessary. And to do that would be an evil, because you're using the oath to try and cover up a lie. Cover up that what you think or what you know on the inside isn't what you're saying on the outside. All right, let's go down now and look at verse 38. And we're going to get more of this backing and forthing. The point of this is that the kingdom isn't going to operate the way Israel's, the apostate nation Israel in Christ's day was operating. It wasn't going to operate in that way. It's going to be totally different. They're not going to be running around inciting anger and causing anger and not worrying about anger. They're going to wake up every morning trying to alleviate anger in themselves, in their friends, and in enemies. They're not going to wake up seeing how they can entice people into lust and bring about lust in the heart for various reasons. They are going to be trying to wake up in the morning. Their sole goal is to alleviate lust in the heart. They're not going to try and fool people with false oaths. They're going to, your yea is going to be yea, and their nay is going to be nay. And they are going to, that's the way that kingdom is going to operate. All right, so now let's see if we can move down through here, and then we'll be set for next week. Verse 38, ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on the right cheek, turn to him that that the other also. And if any man shall sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him too. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not away. And now we have a change in emphasis here. While there was an indication of an adversary back in the anger section, mostly what he had been teaching up to this point had to do with life in that kingdom, with Christ reigning and ruling and what would happen there. But now he's going to take a look, and he's going to give us the operating principles, and giving us the operating principle of that kingdom and how it is applied during a time of persecution. Remember, that's where we started in chapter 5, today in our chapter 5. Just flip back a page and look at verse, chapter 5, verse 11. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Now we go over to the end of chapter 5. Does that sound familiar? It says, but whosoever shall smite thee on the cheek, turn the other way. And whoso take your coat, give me your cloak. Go 1 mile, give him two, and so forth. Now he's bringing what it means for this believing remnant, not when they finally enter the full glory of that kingdom with all its blessings and the new covenant blessings in fulfillment, but how they were to operate now on the basis of how the kingdom will operate out then. And they were supposed to operate on those principles now as they go through a time of persecution. The operating principle of retaliation is ruled out. The kingdom isn't going to operate on the principle of retaliation. It's going to be leave vengeance and justice to the Lord. That's ruled out. And now what he's preparing this believing remnant is that for when they go through this persecution now, this tribulation period, they were supposed to bring the operating principles of the kingdom into their experience under persecution. They're giving the operating principles of the kingdom. And they were supposed to begin operating in accord with that kingdom right then as they were ready to enter the severe persecution of that tribulation period. So now, what is the operating principle of that kingdom? The final bottom line operating principle is the principle of love. And the hope in love is to reconcile all, even your enemies. Verse 43, you have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. And there, that's an addition by the apostate leaders. They were always supposed to love thy neighbor, but hate thine enemy is something added. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them that despitefully use you and persecute you. There's not going to be persecution in that final fulfillment of that kingdom, but there, Jesus explaining to them, they're going to need to operate according to these kingdom principles under persecution before the fulfillment of that of the kingdom blessings, before the glory of the kingdom is brought in. Verse 45, that ye may be the children of your Father. Remember, that was one of the Beatitudes. They were going to be the children of God, which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if ye love him which love you, for what reward have you? Do not even the publicans do the same? And there's a little bit of humor there too, because of course Matthew was a publican, a tax collector. And if you salute your brethren only, what do you more than others? Do not even the publicans do so? He's explaining them. He's given them these basic principles of the kingdom that are going to be in operation and its fulfillment. And they were now supposed to begin to operate according to them in that tribulation period under persecution. And they would have the spirit to empower them. They'd have a foretaste of those kingdom blessings. They would have a foretaste of that new covenant blessing. And that is what would prepare them. That would prepare them for entrance in that kingdom in a unique way. So we'll just close with this. The believing remnant who will be going through the extreme period of suffering and persecution needed to realize that this is another reason why they're blessed. See, this is blessed. The going through this persecution is going to be serve as a blessing, because not because they're going to be suffering or being persecuted or anything, but because this will equip them in a unique way for service in the kingdom. Who better to dispense God's blessings in the kingdom than those who knew what it was like to live not having those blessings under the fifth course of punishment? Who better to dispense mercy than those who had been treated unmercifully? Who better to be peacemakers than those who had been deprived of peace, deprived of shalom, deprived of everything that brings a well-being? Who better to dispense those? Who better in the kingdom? But those who have experienced blessings, not under prosperity, but under adversity. Just think how they're going to be equipped. They are going to be ushered into that kingdom right from that tribulation period, ushered into that kingdom. And there, they are going to dispense God's blessings, but they're going to do it in a different way than everyone else in that kingdom. During that 1,000 years, there's going to be most of the people eventually are going to be born into that kingdom. Born under the prosperous conditions of that kingdom, under that new covenant. But these believing remnant is going to know what it means to experience those blessings without fulfillment. Only a foretaste of it under adverse conditions, under adverse circumstances, under persecution. They are going to be specially equipped to lavishly dispense God's blessings in that kingdom. Who better in the kingdom to spread out God's mercy than those who know what it's like to be treated mercilessly? Who better to extend his peace and grace and all those things than those who had suffered under not having them, not experiencing them, not having them in full, or experiencing them under adversity instead of prosperity? This believing remnant will have a special role in that kingdom. They'll have a perspective that nobody else will ever have. That's using through a foretaste of the kingdom blessings and the new covenant blessings, not under prosperity in that kingdom, but using them, what it's like to live with them in that tribulation under persecution, under adverse circumstances. And here is an application we can make to the body of Christ. Because that's what, in a way, that's what we're going through today, not in light of the kingdom, but in light of the fact God has left us here as his ambassadors on earth to carry his grace and peace out to a world under adverse circumstances, under difficulty, in difficult times, on a sin-cursed world, on enemy territory. And we will never have an opportunity to do this again. That's why it's so important to rightly divide the word, because if you don't, you're not going to know what God's doing today. You won't be able to be his ambassador on earth, and your time down here will be wasted. You may be saved and going to heaven, but God says there's something else that he really wants for us too, and that's to realize that he's left us down here on this adverse world to experience and extend his blessings under adversity. In the future, we'll be extending them under prosperity in that kingdom with the rapture, when we go to be with Christ forevermore and seated in the heavenlies with him. But now is the time to experience these blessings under adversity, which will give us special perspective, special equip us for our roles forevermore in the heavenlies. Let's close with a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, we're so thankful.